Hello, you're welcome to Straight Talk Africa, coming to you from my home in Arlington, Virginia, a suburb of Washington, D.C. I am Shaka Sali, and today we are exploring whether having elections can be considered a prerequisite for democratic governance. Joining us from here in Washington, D.C. are two distinguished guests. Dr. Piwokule Munyandu, a lecturer at Howard University here in Washington, D.C., and Norman Mbabazi, a Ugandan lawyer who is visiting the United States. Well, gentlemen, I have to say that I'm profoundly honored and exceedingly humbled to have the opportunity to host you on Straight Talk Africa.
Pleasure is all ours.
Good to be here.
Good to be here.
It's always a pleasure talking to you guys. And let me wish you, by the way, a hugely happy and prosperous 2021.
Thank you, Shaka. The same to you.
You're most welcome, gentlemen. Now, gentlemen, we're going to be talking about whether holding elections is a prerequisite for democratic or good governance. What, for example, would you say makes an election acceptable to all the parties involved? Makes an election, for example, which can be characterized as free, fair, transparent, verifiable, and a credible election. Professor.
I'm going to perhaps start by using an example I'm personally familiar with, South Africa. Mm-hmm. And I will perhaps answer your question by defining a credible election and a fair election by what actually exists and what doesn't exist at a certain time. There was a time in South Africa until 1994 that not everyone could vote. And so there was democracy, but it was esoteric. It was only for white citizens of South Africa. So that was, so any election then, therefore, that took place before 1994 could not be said to have been credible, fair, and so on and so forth. So we could say then, deduce from that, that a fair and credible election involves the participation of all citizens in electing their representative. So full participation guaranteed, and the election must be, in South Africa, people emphasized this a lot in 1994, free of intimidation, and the choice and the election itself, as far as each citizen, must be a secret ballot. No one must know what you voted, in other words. So these three ingredients, primary ingredients, I would say, using the case of South Africa in 1994, I think I formed a benchmark for the country from which other characteristics, of course, may cohere, I would say. But that's a good start.
So, Doctor, could we then say that perhaps what you are actually trying to put across is that in South Africa, during the apartheid era, we did have what appeared to be democratic elections, but that perhaps these elections, in fact, were a sort of selective democracy, the sort of elections that were clearly not inclusive.
Indeed, that is why the word I used was esoteric democracy, only for a few. So the access, there was a gatekeeping according to race. And so if you were 80% of the population of South Africa, you never knew democracy within the borders of the country until 1994. So if you talk to a South African today who's, let's just say, at the age of 55 and above, if they vote, they voted, they remember that election for the rest of their lives because it was the first time that they and all of us as a result tasted democracy. So an election must have, it must guarantee full participation, and it must guarantee secrecy of the ballot. so that there's no retribution afterwards in areas that are considered a stronghold of this and that a party. I think that's a good benchmark we can take away from the small example of South Africa.
Interesting. What about you, Norman Mbabazi? Is that something that you would agree with?
Speaking from my experience from Uganda, where we've had a series of coups instead of elections, and the times we attempted to have elections in the 80s, they were rigged, and then the current president, General President Museveni, at the time felt that the nature of elections that had been organized by the then government were not those that brought out the characteristics of a democratic society. And when he went to the bush, his idea was he was fighting to for the people to recover their freedom and to be able to exercise their will as democracy requires. However, after that, in 1986, when he took over power, the first times when until 1996, when we held the first election under his regime, and an election which is characterized by the incumbent appointing the referee of the election, where he's playing as a player, creates such a situation that if you don't make reference to me as the leader or as the winner, you will not. Why did I appoint you to be a referee in this game? So, and he has profoundly said that we shall not prepare elections for you to win us. In other words, the elections are a face. So the president will always win, but the people will lose. In other words, the democracy in the Ugandan elections, in my opinion, have never seemed to reflect the intentions or the will of the electorate. So I could simply put it that the many times we've had elections in Uganda, the winner or the selected winner for that matter has always been the one who appoints the referee. So for me, the starting point of a democratic election or an election which has a semblance of democracy, the Electoral Commission must be independent in such a way that it has the will to properly declare the winner if at all the incumbent has lost. And and other characteristics definitely follow an impartial judicial system, that if the election there is a petition, they will substantially look at all the matters to be able to bring out the real issues that occurred in such an election.
What about a free or independent media that can be accessible by the all parties competing, for example, in an election?
Right from 2001, 2011 and 2016, those have been issues pointed out in the various election petitions that should be considered and reformed such that all the participants are able to get access to media coverage. Because how else shall we know the competence of an election if the media is closed out? You've been seeing in the elections, current campaigns that have been going on, that almost 39 journalists, where their credentials were taken away, and the accrediting body also has an appointment by the same the incumbent, who definitely will not accredit various independent journalists who are moving alongside the various campaigning candidates to be able to capture what's happening on ground. So indeed, if we don't have a good media law which allows all the participants to access, to have good publicity, if you don't have a system which is free for media reporting, where there is no censorship, you know, in certain areas where the certain candidates would even pay to be hosted on a TV or a radio program, and a few hours or even minutes to the program starting, and you're told you cannot be allowed to be on this program. And then how else will you communicate to the people? Indeed.
Very interesting. Now, Norman, you basically pretty much characterized the type of elections that happen or obtain in Uganda. How do you respond to President Yoweri Tibuhaburwa, who is on record saying that yes, he actually went to the bush to fight for the restoration of democracy in Uganda, and that he in fact brought you back your democracy? How do you react to that?
He, for me, in my opinion, I think he misrepresents democracy and the semblance of stability in a country. Much as many times he refers to stability in sense to mean democracy. His idea is you are able to speak, you are able to speak as you wish. I've given you freedom of speech, restricted freedom of speech, by the way, and you are able to engage in electoral processes. But these electoral processes are tagged with a lot of circumstances. For example, if you go, the electoral process, which is marred with intimidation, availability of security forces at electoral places, failure to allow all the contestants to navigate the country as they wish, gagging consultations. It is a semblance of democracy in his own words, but in my opinion, that democracy that he preaches does not necessarily reflect the contents of democracy, especially in an electoral process.
Interesting. Now, Dr. Muyando, how do you define, or how do you characterize democracy? We know, for example, that the one great American president by the name Abraham Lincoln, I remember that name precisely because, in fact, I first came across it when I was in Kigezi High School primary, in Kabale, in primary six, studying civics. And when they said democracy, the next thing you'd hear is Abraham Lincoln. That Abraham Lincoln once said that in his view, democracy is a government of the people, by the people, and for the people. What is your definition of democracy as we have seen it being practiced on the ground in Africa?
It's an onerous task, Shaga. I don't think a humble man like myself could give an adequate enough definition of democracy. So I'll even defer to that one and just add to it. Democracy, especially in Southern Africa, I would say, is a dynamic system characterized by change. And also it's an asymmetrical system. Now, it's not equal in many other countries, though it may look so, right? So it's dynamic, characterized by constant change, asymmetrical, it's applied differently or it occurs differently in various countries. And then, of course, whereby the people themselves choose their representatives. And I'll just maintain that humble definition, because once we give it, we start from a humble standpoint when we're defining democracy, we're able to appreciate something very important with democracy in Africa, how it has undergone various stages depending on the country. Some countries have what we might call a mature democracy. What do I mean by that? That is when the party that brought independence has been successfully challenged, Sometimes it has been unseated, as we saw in Zambia. Sometimes it has been challenged to the point of almost losing, and some might say lost, as in the case of ZANU-PF in Zimbabwe in 2008. And then you have nascent democracies. Nascent democracies would be South Africa, would be with ANC, SWAPO in Namibia, Frelimo in Mozambique, Chama Chama Pinduzi in Tanzania, where the parties of independence, the ones that say, and I think this claim sometimes we are being unfair to the parties, so I will not evaluate whether it's good or it's right or wrong for them to say this, but where they say we brought you, like in the case of Uganda, as Paul has outlined, where they say we brought you independence. These are nascent democracies. Whether they've been a democracy for 30 years or 20, they're nascent because the party that rules has not been successfully put through a referendum, a successful referendum, or defeated.
How do you respond to some who would in fact look at that type of democracy as a government of some people, by some people, and for some people?
I think that there are, this is why it's important, full participation guaranteed is an important benchmark of democracy, because once some people find it easier to vote and some do not, once there are barriers to election, in the case of Africa, a barrier could simply be how far is the voting booth in this village? So if you have to walk over 5 kilometers in order to vote in a place where, in a village where not a lot of people have cars, that means the person who brings a bus to transport all of you in this valley, and if that person is wearing a shirt of a certain party, and even if it doesn't say the name, by simply wearing green in Tanzania, you are left with no doubt as to the patronage to whom you owe your vote. And so such practices, these are nuanced practices. So we must have a very clear eye and be careful when we're looking at them. But such practices actually fight against democracy.
And what about you, Norman? What is your definition of democracy as you know it, and as you also have lived through that type of experience?
Well, in a democratic state that I envisage to see many years to come, probably for Uganda, that is to say, where we expect full participation of the people who have reached the age of election, where we all access media, where there is no disenfranchisement of voters, and there is no intimidation. Now, in that state of expectation that my heart feels for, I would, moving away or trying to step aside from the normal norm of democracy being related only to numbers. They say democracy is for numbers. The bigger the number, that's the right democratic decision that has been taken. Now, if I were only to tackle the issue of numbers as a principle of democracy, that creates a problem for Uganda, where the numbers are always computed by certain groups of people and only given to the chairman of the Electoral Commission to announce. So ideally, it would be democratic in their mind, but because it's a numbers game. But the process and the procedure to arrive at a democratic election would have been marred by a lot of activities which defeat the essence of democracy. Especially now, the after effects of such an election in the so-called democratic state is that it totally comes back to what you have just said, a government for certain people, by certain people, because those people who participated in the making of that government come through will definitely be the ones to benefit shortly after its existence.
You know, Norman, I have looked at the trajectory of democracy on the African continent during the last almost 30 years as a professional journalist. And I have found, and this information is also corroborated by a lot of African experts, African observers, policymakers in the Western world who interact and deal with Africa, that when you look at the democratic trajectory as far as Africa is concerned, that it looks good. And the reason they say so is because they say, as you said much earlier, that there was a period in the history of Africa where you hardly held elections. And of course, as we have heard, even in South Africa during apartheid, where they could hold an election, that election was clearly not an inclusive type of democracy. So these people say, when they look at the trajectory of democracy on the African continent, they say it is better because, in their view, most African countries hold periodic elections. How do you respond to that?
The only elections that are held are, in my opinion, are simply to legitimize the regime, but they are not the process. Because you see, elections are two things. It is the process and the result. So if you tamper with the process, then you have ideally managed the result ultimately. Now, what happens in many of these African countries is the process is completely distorted, in the sense that, for example, at the time when Uganda first felt the nature of opposition politics, that's during the time of Dr. Kizza Besigye, he truly stood out as because he was formerly with the ruling party, defected, formed his own party, and he had all the weight with him, and he created his time. We felt at that was the time when Uganda witnessed the strength of the opposition. Dr. Kizza Besigye, with all his might at the time, was arrested not less than 200 times or more. Every other minute he was arrested. All at any one point he attempted to visit a certain constituency, there was intimidation by the military. I want to say that the electoral process in many African countries has been militarized, in the sense that you will not go anywhere during, even the, for example, after elections, we have a 5-year period. And during that time, the gentleman, Dr. Kizza Besigye, in many times could not leave his home. He was not allowed to move. And for me, that's what I call the process.
Norman, wait a minute. You mean Colonel Dr. Kizza Besigye was often arrested for no apparent reason at all? Or is it possible that perhaps he had violated some electoral codes?
The many times he was arrested, it was for no apparent reason, because even when he went to court, he was charged with flimsy charges, and there was never any conviction. Legally, for me, that would be a malicious prosecution, because one, you don't have the facts, the law is not with you, but because of ulterior political motives, there's a point he couldn't go to his bank, because when he moved out, he was the people's president. the government feared his movement would converge people and could, and that was a time when we were having a couple of uprisings in different Arabian countries, the African countries. And the idea was that if the Ugandans are alert and alive to the events in the other African countries, Uganda would also catch the same flu. So they deliberately kept him inside his house to avoid such a situation where he will converge people probably as he moves around and cause peaceful demonstration. He always had peaceful demonstrations. He was the peaceful demonstrations only turned violent when the police tried to block them and stop them from moving or showing their reasons why they are coming out. So I don't think that the gagging or the restraining of Dr. Kizza Besigye was always based on merit, but rather flouting the process of having a democratic election.
You described him as having been perceived by people as quote unquote people's president.
Yes.
Why was he called the people's president, and by whom, and for and why? I mean, and for what?
Because the people did not believe in the outcomes of the election. They always believed that he won the elections. And to the people, that is their person. The will of the people, in their numbers, they believe they chose Dr. Kizza Besigye as their president. But Mr. Museveni was selected for that position, but rather not elected as the people had done so. That's why he is called the people's president.
That sounds like you describing a cult and perhaps Dr. Colonel Kizza Besigye as the cult leader. The only other person I remember in history who was so popular, in fact globally, was Muhammad Ali, formerly Cassius Clay.
Yes.
At one time, obviously, the most prominent global fighter in terms of boxing, the heavyweight champion. People could not believe, even when he was beaten very badly in Madison Square Garden in New York by Joe Frazier, they still thought he had won, and they called him the people's champion, Muhammad Ali.
Muhammad Ali.
Even though in many ways one could argue that he probably deserved it, given the kind of prominence he really did and some of the important causes that he embraced that made him obviously the individual that was globally loved, adored, worshipped to some degree, as a matter of fact.
I think, if I may, I think this discussion when someone has not won or is perceived to have, but is perceived to have won the election, whether rightly or wrongly, I think it brings a very important aspect of African democracy with which we must contend. This idea that one personality, whether they are opposition or not, tends to encapsulate or capture the support of a region or sometimes an ethnicity. So in our analysis of African democracy, we must not leave, like exceptions exist there and there, but we must also contend with this idea. I think fool ourselves sometimes when we're looking at Africans and their choices sometimes. In some countries, one person or a dynasty or an opposition party, sometimes they tend to be viewed as coming from one region or ethnicity. And I think in its quest to be fair and to improve, and it's a and this occurs